Tuesday night in Radio 3 live in concert from Cardiff, starting at 7:30.
Now it's 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Andrew Graham Dixon has been chief art critic of both The Independent and, more recently, The Sunday Telegraph. He's had a long and productive career with the BBC, for whom he's made several series of programmes, including last year The Art of Germany. A choice and individual turn of phrase informs his writing, and his most recent book is Caravaggio. He's quite a sort of legend in his own right, really, quite apart from the painting, wasn't he?
Caravaggio, yeah, you could say that, yeah. He certainly was a legend and deserved to be one. But what a character. The trouble I had when trying to write his life was trying to make people believe that this really was the truth, that this really was his life. Because what is known from the legend is in a peculiar way so much less, although sensational in itself, killing a man in a sword fight, running away, getting his face terribly badly slashed, outside a gay bar in early 17th century Naples and the rest of it. But the recent discoveries and the discoveries that I've been able to publish in my book are yet more extraordinary. So the difficulty was to sort of tone it down.
And in fact, that kind of vivacity is there in the painting, isn't it, too? I mean, the colours just sort of almost shriek at you in some ways.
There's a kind of nakedness about his way of seeing the world. I mean, a real nakedness. And I don't know quite where it comes from. I think it comes from early childhood. And when he was five, almost his entire male family was killed in a terrible outbreak of the plague. And I remember when I was researching the book, I stumbled across some extraordinary eyewitness accounts of that plague written by a Jesuit who was there at the time. And he describes the city at night, Bishop Borromeo urging the people to bring paintings and sculptures out of the churches outside to light bonfires and to pray. And meanwhile, over there, 100 people in carts, their dead bodies are being taken for burial. And when you think forward to the pictures that Caravaggio will paint, perhaps some 20 years after this, it's as if he's, in some sense, it's as if he's reliving those night terrors throughout his life.
Your childhood, Andrew, was less colourful than that, but it certainly was, I imagine, surrounded and peopled by music to a certain extent.
Yeah, in a way, I feel that I spent a large part of my childhood rigorously avoiding music, rigorously avoiding being channelled in the direction of music. And my father, he's now retired, but he was a commercial lawyer, but I think he had originally wanted to be an opera singer and only decided not to be an opera singer when he realised that his talents meant that he would forever be confined to the role of a spear carrier. And his mother, my grandmother, she was a concert pianist. She had two beautiful grand pianos in the big house in Sussex where I remember going to visit her. And my mother spent most of her life as an adult, or a very large part of it, working in music, working with music festivals in Florence and overseas, and working with the Jan Lathan Koenig Ensemble. So I was expected to be more musical than I was. So I ended up, of course, going into the direction of art. I love music, but I just didn't have the patience or the gifts to actually really learn an instrument.
Your first piece is a transporting one.
Wagner. Yes, it's a bit of Wagner without any singing.
Deliberately?
I just think it's an intoxicating, extraordinary piece of music. And to me, it's a piece of music that somehow, in a way that I don't have the language to define, but it's a piece of music that takes that classical tradition and that operatic tradition just into another place. To me, it feels like the beginning of, well, I suppose one can always talk about the beginning. You could say the same, in a sense, about Beethoven as the beginning of modern music, but there's just something so extraordinary about it, so revolutionary. And Wagner was a revolutionary, contrary to his sort of this rather sort of silly idea that he's a neo-Nazi that's been put about because of what other people thought of him in the 20th century, but he was a revolutionary figure and an extraordinary figure and an idealistic person who, especially in his youth, genuinely believed that the world might be altered. And somehow what I love about that piece of music is not, you know, there's so much emotion and hope and belief and desire. I mean, it's extraordinary. It's sort of, to me, it's just like a piece of music that takes hold of you. I feel so sorry for the singer who has to interrupt it. I shouldn't say that. I just think, how can you live up to that with just a voice?
Well, the singer we heard was Oda Balsborg, who appears as Voglinda just after the prelude to Das Rheingold by Wagner. And we heard the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir George Shorty. It's always very amazing when you actually go to sit through the entire ring, and that's the first note you hear, and you realise you're just sitting down for something that, in its entirety, will take 18 hours. Now, Beethoven, Andrew, I wonder whether you found out quite a bit about this when you were doing the German programmes, because presumably music overlaps with quite a lot of that.
Well, I've managed to remain very unknowledgeable about music. I mean, perhaps because I spend my working life trying to find out a lot of things about art and artists and facts, and trying to relate them to movements in perhaps poetry or literature, that I sort of have somehow tried to leave music out. It's just something that I enjoy without getting my brain too heavily involved. But one thing I would say is that when we were making that series about German art, and I was thinking a lot about Romanticism, thinking about Runge and Friedrich and this extraordinary Romantic tradition of German literature also, a penny sort of did slide. I thought, well, actually, hang on, you are allowed to think a bit about music. And of course, you know, I feel that Beethoven, if I were to try to put my sort of, as I say, idiot instinctive musical finger on the pulse of what he did, it seems to me that he developed a way of writing music that somehow completely expressed the fluctuations of the human spirit. It's almost like he created a musical equivalent to the texture of lived experience in a way that, for me, I can't quite hear in any previous musician. I can't quite hear that in Bach or
Mozart.
The
classical idea. No, exactly. There's a kind of Sturm und Drang. There's the turbulence, isn't there, in Beethoven, of the human condition.
Yes, and stop-start, and where's this piece of music going, and quite what's happening. And if you've been listening to a lot of Mozart and you listen to some Beethoven, it's so angular and harsh and difficult, and you think, oh, I think that's another thing. It's very true that if you get acclimatized to one form of music or perhaps one composer, it's the same with art. When I first started looking at art, I was only in Florence. I was only looking at the Florentine Renaissance. I was only looking at, you know, that tradition. And I went to Venice and I thought, oh, what's this? And it was as if I'd turned into Giorgio Vasari, you know, the great apologist for the Tuscan Roman side of painting. And, you know, oil paint? No, this is horrible. And I think, in a way, to move from Mozart to Beethoven is a bit, for me, like moving from Florence to Venice. It's such a different...
Yes, it gets down and dirty in a way. It gets quite muscular, and there's all the suffering in it. And of course, you know, he had to contend with deafness and pretty difficult conditions given his own temperament.
Yes, and you've sensed that. I mean, I think that's why I'm particularly drawn to the late string quartets. Also because it makes it so naked somehow. It's almost as if those string instruments have this ability somehow as well. In my mind, somehow, that the string instrument is on its own. There's an extraordinary plaintiveness about the sounds that they make, and it's as if they're talking to each other. like listening to someone think out loud, or feel out loud.
Part of the third movement of Beethoven's String Quartet in A minor, opus 132, played by the Guarneri Quartet. Complete change of mood now. But actually, rather wonderful version of this sort of music.
Wow, I just think, I've never heard anything like this guy. I mean, I was given, to be accurate, my wife was given by her father, who loved jazz and played jazz when he was at Cambridge many, many years ago, given this album of blues music. And it was my real first introduction, this would be about 20 years ago, to Boogie Woogie Piano, and I just couldn't believe. I still now, when I listen to this, there are certain places in it where I think there must be two people playing the piano. How could one person have... do they call it a stride? That big and an ability to somehow move so quickly. And it's sort of joyful, and to me it's the sort of musical equivalent of joy unconfined.
Wonderful.
I love the way he just signs off so gently. Well, he can play at my party anytime. This joins his jumping. I mean, wow.
Chicago Breakdown by Maceo Merriweather. Do you play the piano at all?
Well,
not like that, but
no. The thing is, I did actually about 6 or 8 years ago think, well, maybe I'll try and learn a bit of blues piano, and I started doing it. I had a very good teacher. She basically was telling me, oh, forget about sheet music, just do this, play this riff, and think of it more like drumming than playing the piano. You're almost drumming with the notes. And then, of course, I listened to this again, and I thought, oh, forget it. Just forget it. Listen to him. Don't you? Somebody said, what's the secret of being a great jazz pianist? Was that the question? And he said, oh, you give up your whole childhood and just spend it in a darkened room playing the piano. I mean, yeah. He's put in a lot of hours, that guy.
Tell me, Andrew Graham Dixon, are you... Do you think we're living in a very exciting time from the point of view of art, the art's been created now?
It depends what you mean by art. I think that one of the problems I have now is actually, and I don't mean it in the sun's sense of, is it art, is it not art?
No, no.
I actually mean that I have trouble with categorising things, because so much art now that you see in, say, Tate Modern seems to take the form of moving images. So I think, well, hang on, if moving images are allowed in Tate Modern, why aren't Martin Scorsese films or Godard films or you know, wonderful films like Dead Man by Jim Jarmusch, why aren't they allowed in Tate Modern? The other thing that I was thinking is, say, John Cage, the famous silent piece of music. Well, is it music? You know, the point is that it's 4 minutes during which you focus on the world. So you could see it as a work of visual art. You're not just listening to the sound of the trains outside or the sound of somebody coughing in the auditorium. You're also looking. It's about creating a sense of heightened attention. I think the arts, I mean, as they did during the Romantic period, there's a strong feeling a lot of people had that the arts were sort of morphing into one another, and that people were writing music that they wanted people to see things when they heard the music, and other people were painting pictures and they wanted people to hear music when they looked at the pictures. And I think we live in times perhaps that are somewhat analogous to that. I mean, I think the problem that we have that perhaps generations in the past didn't quite have is that we are bombarded, thanks to, you know, the nature of modern media and the nature of modern metropolitan urban existence and so on. We are so bombarded by, potentially bombarded by cultural experience, and it's so available to us. I mean, I actually like to try to restrict it. You know, I like to not always I mean, I hate it in restaurants where there's music playing. If I want to listen to music, I want to listen to music. I don't want to be talking to somebody and half being sort of assailed. You know, it's almost worse if the music's good.
Well, you certainly wouldn't want to listen to the next piece as background music in a restaurant.
No, you would not. Now, this, I've chosen this. I mean, this piece of music I love. It was introduced to me by a great friend of mine at The Independent, a considerably older friend called Bruce Bernard, who's no longer with us.
Oh, yes.
He's brother of Geoffrey Bernard, and he, in his own right, an absolutely remarkable photographer, photograph editor. He worked as a picture editor, and just a remarkable man. And I remember that he chose this piece of music to be played at a wake. As his own wake, he designed his own wake. He knew he was going to die. He did die. And then he arranged this wake where all his friends went to a large house. I think it was in Holland Park somewhere that had been rented for the occasion. It was a huge conservatory. And Bruce was a great... He loved his wine, and he'd got 100 bottles or something of Chateau Musard, this very tannic, delicious, old Lebanese wine. So we drank that.
Very alcoholic.
Very alcoholic. So everyone's kind of quite sort of relaxed. And the only time he wanted everyone in the party just to be silent and, as it were, think about him or just listen was when he decided to play this beautiful piece of music by Bach. And as soon as the music started, we were in this conservatory, as soon as the music started, one of those storms that you can't believe that rain could fall with such intensity, the sky was crying for Bruce, and it just down onto this conservatory. And as soon as the music stopped, the rain stopped. And it was just one of the most extraordinary things. Any of us in the room, we all felt it. It was just an extraordinary moment.
Thank you.
I have the sense that the way that he plays that piece, and the nature of the piece as well, is such that anybody who thinks perhaps they only like jazz, or you know, thinks they only like pop music, I would challenge anybody not to find something in that piece of music that would just touch them to the soul. It's an astonishing piece of music.
The Chaconne from the Partita No. 2 in D minor for solo violin BWV 1004 by Bach, of which we heard a part. Nathan Milstein was playing the violin. This brings us very neatly on to improvisation, Andrew Graham Dixon, because, of course, in a lot of realisation of Bach, where there are many more parts, he would simply have what he called a figured bass, you know, and the continuo player on the harpsichord would improvise. And our next piece is a keyboard player improvising, but in his own style very much.
It's very different, but I think I'm very intrigued by improvisation as an idea, and I think you get something when you improvise. I mean, I'm thinking about it actually in terms, not that I'm calling myself an artist. I'm just saying, in terms of my own career as a presenter, I used to work with completely prepared scripts. I even had an auto cue. Now I just try to know what I'm going to say, and then I say it. And I find that what I get, it may be that I lose precision and focus, and people
it's
may
more spontaneous.
People may prefer what I did before, is what I'm saying, but I prefer what I do now. And I think what it enables you to do is that you have a structure that you riff on. It enables you to express your emotions more clearly, immediately, and directly. And I think that perhaps that's also true for musicians. I've never discussed it with a musician, but I wonder, this piece of music particularly.
No, I think it's absolutely true. And in fact, I'd broaden it out because, you know, one that we've seen, in fact, on programmes, we've seen painters, footage of Stravinsky, because I see him as a parallel of Picasso, just putting brushstrokes onto a canvas with huge speed. And there's an element of improvisation there, clearly.
And within a structure. Yeah. I think it goes back to what Flaubert said, if you want to live like a bohemian, organise yourself like a bourgeois.
So this is Keith Jarrett.
This is Keith Jarrett. I think the story I heard is that he found this rickety old piano that was half out of tune, but he just loved the weirdness of it and spent hours and hours improvising on it. And the result was this album, Staircase. And I particularly love the very end of this improvisation, where everything seems to come together in just a very beautiful, slightly melancholic way.
Part of Staircase Part 3, Keith Jarrett. Glenn Miller next.
Well, yeah, I chose this because I think one of the functions of music can be, it's almost like practical. For me, this is like musical equivalent of Prozac. I challenge anybody who wakes up in a bad mood, feeling sad, feeling melancholic, feeling perhaps that they haven't quite got there, get up and go. You put this on.
And you're off to the races.
You're off to the races. It just changes. I think it's a great piece of music to start your day with.
Thank you.
best taken with a cup of coffee and some early morning sunshine filtering through the window. But although, of course, I'd probably spill the coffee.
Glenn Miller, In the Mood. Actually, it's important to say that it's arranged by Glenn Miller, and the composers were Joe Garland and Andy Razza. That's the kind of piece that passes into history, you know, mythologically, as being by Glenn Miller. But actually, two other guys wrote it. We're going to go back, Andrew Graham Dixon, to your grandmother now, really, aren't we?
Yeah, my grandmother was a concert pianist and occasionally played the piano so that we could hear it. And not only that, but my wife's family is full of piano players. So I've got a lot of memories of sort of early life and young adulthood of being in large houses with music playing, perhaps children on bicycles outside. Music as a part of life. Music is something that you could slip in and out of. You could be lying under the piano as a small child, listening to the music, watching the feet pedalling, or you could be outside coming into a room. And somehow music being part of life. And it's this Schubert impromptus that I feel very much are that kind of music. Something wonderfully light and evocative about them to me.
When you were making notes for this programme, you talked about it. This is all like why I think you're a good writer about art. You talked about it being like a Baroque fountain in sound.
I was just struggling to find a way of expressing what the music feels like to me. But it does feel like it makes me think of those extraordinary gardens at Tivoli, with water flowing down a structure, and that somehow he's written a piece of music that evokes that. I don't know whether he meant to, but it's what it does for me.
certainly cascading.
Yeah, I feel wet.
Wonderful playing by Wilhelm Kempff there in Schubert's Impromptu in E-flat, Deutsch 899, number 2. We're going to finish by contrasting what we just heard, i.e. precision and sort of brilliant execution, with something which is deliberately raw and rough.
Yeah, I hope it doesn't alienate everybody, make them think how terribly vulgar I am. But now I think this is one of the great pieces of music of the 20th century. It's by the Sex Pistols. It's by John Lydon, who I always thought was a sort of misunderstood poet, intellectual. And then I met him, interviewed him for the Culture Show, and I realised that's exactly what he is. Extremely bright, sensitive, extraordinary, creative, brilliant human being. And I think that we Brits don't like to recognise, or perhaps sometimes don't like to remember, how key and core to our whole being as a nation, to our whole history as a people, the desire to completely destroy everything is. And I say that because my first serious book was called A History of British Art, and I spent 8 years trying to work out the answers to questions I started asking myself as a PhD student writing about the 18th century. And it was only by going back to the Reformation, this moment when the British destroyed everything, smashed all the stained glass windows, smashed all the statues, smashed all established ways of thinking as well as established forms of religion. And as Christopher Hill said, without all that destruction, perhaps you'd never have had the great British scientific revolution. And I think that this song by Lydon, stroke Rotten, if you just forget all of the Malcolm McLaren packaging and the traditional sort of perhaps not taking seriously the Sex Pistols that's been the sort of, as it were, the knee-jerk reaction of most people for years and years and years, I actually think when you look at it as a piece of music that expresses a part of the British psyche, the British soul, it's just absolutely incredible, exuberant, iconoclastic, fantastic. Sounds so classical to me now, you see.
Well, I was just thinking there will be some listening for whom anarchy in the UK would indeed be the Sex Pistols on Radio 3. But we are a broad and Catholic church.
I'm glad to hear it. I was thinking when you say broad and Catholic church, I was thinking it's like a hymn.
Yeah.
It's actually like a hymn to the notion of destroying everything.
It is strange how music that caused a huge stir becomes strangely, I don't know what the right word is, acceptable or part of the norm or the mainstream.
You see it in art. Andy Warhol said near the end of his life, he said, looking back at his very first pictures, some of the Heinz soup tins, which were all carefully hand-painted, he said, gosh, they look really classical, don't they? By the standards of what people were doing at that point, i.e. Jean-Michel Basquiat, graffiti art, you know, that early art. Jackson Pollock's a great example. You know, flinging the paint around. Now you look at a Jackson Pollock, it's like visiting a cathedral. It feels classic. I'm fascinated by, and it seems to me, I was listening to that just now, I felt, gosh, actually, for me, that has crossed over. It's crossed over. It's actually a classic.
Andrew Graham Dixon, thank you very much. Are you working at the moment on a particular book or a series that you're riveted by?
I am about to go to Sicily to try to fathom the mysteries of Sicilian culture, history, and also Sicilian food. I'm going with a friend, Giorgio Locatelli, the chef, and we're trying to get to grips with Sicily. That's for a documentary.
That doesn't sound like an appallingly awful assignment.
Well, this is what I said. This is, if the programme ends up looking like Georgia and me being on holiday being filmed, it will have failed. So if we enjoy ourselves too much, it won't be good, because we've got to try and understand some stuff. And the other thing I'm working on is a three-part series called The Art of America, which is the latest in a series of series about the art of different nations.
Well, we look forward to that, and meanwhile, thank you very much for letting us hear the music you're particularly fascinated by.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
Andrew Graham Dixon was talking to Michael Barclay, and next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the novelist and poet Helen Dunmore. That's next Sunday at the same time, midday. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and today's edition was produced by Chris Marshall.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
The transforming effect of the voice raised in worship.
Hallelujah.
Radio 3 brings you a week of programs exploring the vocal traditions of five different faiths with international performers of sacred song from the Christian, Hindu, Muslim, Jewish and Sikh traditions. I'm Lapa Kotari, and every night this week I'm bringing you performances from the Manchester International Festival in some of the city's most sacred sites. A rare opportunity to join performers, communities and audiences as we explore and celebrate sacred song and how it affects people. Join me for Sacred Sites, 11 o'clock each night this week here on BBC Radio 3.
Back to this Sunday lunchtime in a couple of minutes. We're live at this year's York Early Music Festival for today's early music show. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock. Time for the news now read by David Cornett.
Rupert Murdoch flew into Britain this morning to take charge of News International's response to the scandal over alleged payments to police and phone hacking, which prompted the closure of the News of the World. He arrived at Luton Airport and is now at the paper's East London headquarters at Wapping. The Labour leader, Ed Miliband, has said he'll try to force a Commons vote in an attempt to halt Mr Murdoch's takeover of the broadcaster B Sky B until police inquiries are completed. He'll raise the issue in an opposition day debate on Wednesday. A meeting between David Cameron and relatives of Millie Dowler, the murdered teenager whose phone was hacked, has been delayed at the request of the family until later this week. They'll meet the Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg in the morning as planned. £8 million has been raised after relief agencies in East Africa issued a joint appeal for around 10 million people in countries suffering drought. Thousands of people are arriving every day from Somalia at already overcrowded camps in northern Kenya. The UN Refugee Agency now says charities should go into southern Somalia to help. Some reports say the authorities in southern Somalia are preventing civilians fleeing the drought and heading for refugee camps. One Somali aid worker said militant Islamists had set up their own camp outside the capital, Mogadishu. The Syrian Foreign Ministry has called in the American and French ambassadors to protest about their visits to the city of Hama on Friday during anti-government demonstrations. It accused them of undermining Syria's stability. The regime has opened what it calls a comprehensive national dialogue on moves towards a multi-party democratic state, but many opposition figures are boycotting the talks. The online retailer Amazon is creating 900 jobs. It's opening a site in Staffordshire in September to process internet orders. And the weather, after a dry start, showers and light winds will cross much of the UK, and in the Midlands and Wales these could be heavy and thundery. In the southeast, temperatures will be around 20 degrees, in Wales and Scotland around 17 degrees. BBC News and weather at 1:02.
And it was read by David Cornett. It's time now on Radio 3 for the Early Music Show, and we're going live to the York Early Music Festival. Here's Catherine Bott.
Welcome to York. Well, the National Centre for Early Music is packed as we assemble once again for the 8th year running, I think, to enjoy the traditional live show that kicks off the York Early Music Festival. Well, to be honest, it started on Friday, but we have caught up with it this year. This year's festival theme takes us back in time. Well, you might expect that, mightn't you? But just 60 years to 1951 and the Festival of Britain. The festival was a celebration of the best of British, a loving glance at our national character, and a hopeful look at a bright new world of scientific discovery and innovative design. To people of a certain generation, I probably only have to say Skylon or Dome of Discovery for everybody to come over all misty-eyed. But the festival wasn't just about that great exhibition on London's South Bank. There were events all over the country. Here in York, for example, the mystery plays were performed for the first time in 400 years, and there were concerts which featured harpsichord music by Orlando Gibbons and John Bull. The term early music didn't officially exist in 1951, but among the Festival of Britain's cultural activities in London was a series of concerts with the snappy, audience-grabbing title of Music by English Composers 1300 to 1750. They were put on by the newly established Arts Council of Great Britain, which felt that the glories of this earlier period of our musical heritage have always been appreciated by scholars, but are seldom illuminated through performance. Well, you fast forward 60 pioneering years, and the York Early Music Festival programme is studded with repertoire from that concert series. Later on, I'll be talking to festival director Delma Tomlin and artistic advisor John Bryan. But the main thrust of this live early music show is live performance from a vocal group that has represented the best of British for more than four decades. The Festival of Britain was officially a tonic to the nation. And here's another one. To sing four Elizabethan madrigals from the Triumphs of Oriana, let's welcome the King's Singers.
Joyfully, how joyful!